Friends, I just did my annual economic briefing with author and Swiss America chairman Craig R. Smith, and what I discovered confirms my worst fears. Something is getting ready to happen that's going to change the course of world history, and not one in a thousand will believe it until it's already too late, and I don't want that to be you. After writing four important books accurately predicting the future of gold, oil, the dollar, and inflation, Mr. Smith is on the verge of releasing his next book, and this new CD covers the root issue of the coming crisis and offers three critical steps to protect your family from the fallout. Please call today for this hot new CD, The Future of Money. Toll free, 888-559-9920, 888-559-9920. You've got to hear The Future of Money to believe it. 888-559-9920, 888-559-9920. Do it today.
Raw Nation's Hot Rocks is the only raw, vegan, certified organic vitamin for your sex drive. Hot Rocks is made using only the purest organic superfoods and herbs in their raw, unaltered state. We've created this synergistic blend of powerful herbs that intensifies sexual energy and performance in both men and women. It's like an overall vitality pill that makes you feel amazing. There's absolutely no chemicals, pesticides, or harsh stimulants in Hot Rocks. If you already have a strong sex drive, Hot Rocks will help you maintain it and keep it from slipping away, a problem that affects even the healthiest people nowadays because of the amount of toxicity that we are all exposed to. So what are you waiting for? We offer a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can order Hot Rocks risk-free. It's time to experience pure bliss and the only truly healthy libido enhancer on the market, Hot Rocks. Order online at hotrocks.com. That's HOTRAWKS.com or call us 855-RAW-LIFE. That's 855-729-5433.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery, and our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to Survival and Beyond. I'm your host, Ed Corcoran, here on Natural News Radio, and we're also broadcasting on the Prepper Podcast Radio Network, and it's great to have you guys listening. I'm really glad all you folks are tuning in, because you know what, apart from the survival and preparedness information that I like to put out on the show, what's even more important to me is waking people up and just shaking people out of their complacency and spreading the word and getting awareness. I mean, you know, liberty, freedom. If you're a patriot, you know, you need to hear this stuff. If you're not a patriot, if you don't know what's going on, you need to hear it even more, you know. And if you're concerned about liberty, you're concerned about your freedom, you're concerned about not having to explain to your children why they are now slaves, And we need to get as many people activated as possible. And you know what? Sometimes it gets depressing because it seems like the vast majority of this country are idiots. They're sleeping, brainwashed freaking sheep. And I know my listeners, I don't think that you're among them, you know, but maybe there's somebody's tuning in. Maybe somebody's just starting to wake up. They're starting to get concerned about what's going on. And they don't know, they can't tell a conspiracy theory from the real truth, or they can't tell what the government's telling them from the real truth. And I'll tell you what, I do not deal in conspiracy theories, okay? People think I'm a conspiracy theorist, because when I talk about the oligarchy and the banksters and the Federal Reserve and the globalists and the UN agenda and the Marxist in the White House, our Marxist in chief, you know, so, oh, geez, you're a conspiracy theorist. Oh, where's your tinfoil hat and everything? You know what? It's not a conspiracy theory, because it's right out there. It's right out in plain view. You know, every day, even the fake news that you get from the worthless mainstream media, you know, it's even that stuff should freaking alarm you. It should frighten the hell out of you to hear about the drones and the NDAA and all the rights being taken away from us and our guns being taken away from us and the Constitution is being usurped, because you know what? The vast majority of people in this country have no freaking idea what the Constitution is. They've never read it. They have a vague awareness of it. What they were taught in school was almost nothing, almost worthless, you know. So if you're a patriot and you're concerned and you really care about your freedom, then you got to stand up and you got to say something. You got to educate people and you got to make people aware, you know. And boy, you know, I'm fired up today, because you know, it's just every single day it gets a little bit worse. Every single day I hear something or I read something that's going on in this country that absolutely just infuriates me, or it shocks me, or it flabbergasts me. I don't know how this can happen, you know, with our dictator in the White House ruling by executive order, and you know, and they just keep on coming. The executive orders just keep on flying, and there's another one that was recently signed that I'm gonna get to in a minute, which involves, you know, the ongoing war, you know, our warmongering state. But you know, you gotta have passion if you believe in what this country is about, and if you know, freedom isn't just a word, you know. Liberty is not just a word. It's not a quaint little bygone notion, okay? It's not something that was, oh, well, that was nice for, like, you know, 230 years ago. No, this is today. It's still alive, but it's dying. It's dying, and it will die if you let it. It's happened all over the world. This is a new country, you know? This is a fairly new country, and we walk around thinking it's been like this. We think it's been like this forever. You know, people think that this is the way it's always been. You know, it hasn't always been this way. It wasn't this way 100 years ago, or I should say, it's been this way for the last 100 years. You know, ever since the institution of the central bank, the Federal Reserve, we've been sold into slavery. Yeah. If you don't think you're a slave, you know, why do you need to get permission from the government for everything? You think you own anything? You don't own anything. If you did, then you would need, you know, if you own a house, you own land, you own property, you don't really own that. If you did, you wouldn't need to get a permit to build on it or to make renovations. You know, if you still think you own your house, try stop paying your property taxes and see how long you still own it. We would need to get a license, which is basically permission from the government to drive a car. You know, all of these things we have to answer to the government for. The government is not here to regulate us. The Constitution is not here to give power to the government. The Constitution is here to give power to the people, and we're letting that slip away. And I can't stand it. I can't take it anymore. I've been talking about this on my old show, and it's getting worse. And the stupidity of most of the American people, again, my listeners accepted, of course, it astounds me. It astounds me. The complacency. People just don't care. So, even those who can see the writing on the wall and those people who do see our rights being eroded away, you know, those people who are insightful enough and can pull their head out of the television set, tear themselves away from American Idol or Dancing with the Stars for freaking five minutes to see what's going on, you know. You see it all the time, the pundits, you know, watch your Sunday morning programs. I don't. I gave up watching television years ago, but, you know, every now and then, you know, I can still see this stuff online. And, you know, the pundits and the critics and everything, they're all making apologies and they're all whitewashing it away, you know. You're going to whitewash your rights away if you keep saying, oh, well, it's never going to get that bad and that'll never happen, not in this country, blah, 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 you know, and everything, is because you've been filled with propaganda ever since you went through the indoctrination program that I call the public school system, you know. excuse me. I know it because I've been through it. I went through it. I grew up believing America is the greatest country and no other country in the world has freedom except for us. And, you know, and America is such a miracle and everything. And we're just like, we're all like, you know, brainwashed and conditioned to just take that for granted. You cannot take that for granted. You cannot take your rights and your freedom for granted because it is being taken away from you. It is not coming down the road, folks. It's here. We're in a police state. We're in a slave state. The whole way our culture is set up is slavery. You know, if we weren't slaves, again, we wouldn't need to get permission for everything. We wouldn't we wouldn't be in the state that we're in right now. But I'm not here to spend a lot of time with a philosophical exposition. I'm here to talk about some of the things that I mean, there's so much news that I don't ever have time to address at all, and the stuff that really that really concerns me and really infuriates me. But you know, if you're at all a patriot, if you're at all concerned about liberty, you got to not only don't just pay attention to what I'm saying, you know. Don't pay attention to what Crazy Ed's telling you. You know, it's like, go out and find out for yourself, because it's all out there. You know, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's not like, you know, the Illuminati might exist, but I can't concern myself with the Freemasons and the Illuminati and lizard people in the White House and, you know, whether the president is, you know, taking orders from aliens or whatnot, you know. And it doesn't mean I don't read about it. It doesn't mean I don't know about it. It doesn't mean I don't think about it or can have conjecture and everything like that. And it doesn't mean that I don't think a lot of that is true, you know. But I can't be concerned about it because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You run around in circles and, you know, and start shouting Illuminati and whatever, and that's great. It might exist, but the main thing is we have to deal with what's going on right now. We have to deal with the police state that we're living in. We have to deal with the fact that we've got drones, we've got NDAA, we've got, we've got an election where there's only one man who stands for anything that you know has anything to do with the Constitution, and that's Ron Paul, and he's being subjugated. We're gonna get to that as well, hopefully. But awful amusing story about Mitt Romney in Poland, though, isn't it? But the first thing I wanted to talk about is I'm just spitting mad. The first thing I want to talk about is something that I brought up on the show before. I talked about Colorado, the state of Colorado, and their water rights, and the state. It is illegal for you to have a rain catchment system in the state of Colorado. You cannot collect rain water and store it for your own personal use in Colorado, because Colorado claims that they have rights to all the water in the state, including the water that falls from the sky. a ludicrous assertion if I ever heard one. You know, who can own the rain? You know, this is just like Chief Seattle talking about, you know, the concept of land ownership. You know, the Native Americans, they had no, it was our Western, this is an invention of our Western European forefathers who came over here with the notion that they were going to buy up the land. And when you think about it, it really is a ludicrous concept. It is a ludicrous concept to believe that you can own land. The land was here before us, and it's here for, you know, we are the only, human beings are the only creatures who have to pay to live on Earth. Think about it that way, you know. Try to take get your mind out of that particular box. Like, oh, well, if you want to own land, then you have to pay for it and pay taxes on it, which is another reason that shows you why we don't own the land. If you think you own your house, you think you own your property, you know, stop paying your property tax and see how long you still possess it. You know, if you really owned your land, you owned your property, you wouldn't have to go to the government for permission to build on it or to renovate your house. You wouldn't, if we owned anything, we wouldn't need permission from the government. We shouldn't have permission from the government. It wasn't like that over 100 years ago. You know, it wasn't, we didn't have to go and fill out paperwork and pay fees and get approval from the government if we wanted to build a house or if we wanted to add an addition to our house. You know, we don't own anything, and that's another example of how we're slaves. But anyway, getting back to the rain catchment situation, there at the time when I first reported about the state of Colorado, I had surmised that, you know, I assume there must be other states that have similar laws, and there in fact are. I didn't really dig too deep about it until I came across this story, but there are four states that I'm aware of that have similar restrictions on storing, catching and storing rainwater for your own personal use. And those states are Colorado, Washington, Utah, and Oregon. And I found out about Oregon today when I came across a story where there's a man, Mr. Gary Harrington of Eagle Point, Oregon, who was sentenced to 30 days in prison plus a $1,500 fine for catching rainwater for his own personal use. Now, I can understand having regulations, having water rights laws, especially in the southwestern states, especially in the desert states. I used to live in Arizona, so I can sort of understand Utah's point of view. But the thing is, we're not talking about diverting waterways to your property for your own exclusive personal use and depriving other people in your community or in your county or your municipality of the use of that water. We're not talking about that. We're talking about rain. We're talking about waters falling from the sky. Okay. Nobody's getting deprived if somebody catches the rain. The water tables are not dropping. The reservoirs are not drying up because, you know, people are catching rain. Less than 3% or just about 3% of all rainfall ends up in reservoirs anyway. The rest of it evaporates or it gets absorbed into the ground. So, you know, you're not stealing water from, you know, they're acting like this is theft, like this is a crime. And Harrington actually got a permit to catch rain. You can get a permit in the state of Washington. You know, and I don't even know why they're concerned about it. I mean Oregon, not Washington. Well, I don't know why Washington's concerned about it either. I mean, the amount of rainfall they get, I mean, it's not like they're Utah or Arizona where they have drought constantly. But in Oregon, you can get a permit. And the fact that you have to get a permit, I mean, that just insults me as a sovereign person. That just insults me as a human being that I have to go to a government agency and say, "Oh, please, mister, please, can I please have permission to catch rain?" It's ludicrous. But he did get the permit, and then they decided to revoke his permit. You know, and you know, he went through all the steps. He did everything by the numbers and everything. And they decided to revoke his permit, and they gave him 3 years probation. And, well, you know, he had the 3 years probation. The law actually doesn't say anything about catching rain. It just covers tributaries and streams and whatnot. There's not a, you know, and he was also catching snowmelt runoff. And there's absolutely nothing in the law whatsoever about catching rain in the first place. So he's appealing this. He has 2 weeks until he has to report to the county jail to serve his 30-day sentence. I don't know how the appellate process works in his county, but I don't think two weeks is enough for him to appeal. But I don't know. I could be talking out of my hat as well. But really, this is just beyond insanity. I mean, claiming that the state or anybody owns the rain, you know, it's like you might as well say that you own the moon. And you know what? I'm in fact surprised that the United States government didn't annex the moon when we went there in 1969. You know, that flabbergasted me that we didn't do it. It's like, hey, it was like, we got here first, so it's ours, you know. You can't own the rain. And somebody going to prison for catching the rain is just absolutely. I don't even have words for it. So, you know, it's not hurting anybody. Again, it's a victimless crime. It's not like he's stealing water from his neighbors. It's not like everybody's going thirsty because he's got three reservoirs on his property. He's got like 170 odd acres. And three reservoirs, they're ponds actually. And, according to this story. So, you know, that's what we're looking at. You know, I know it's not the big, bad federal, you know, government. This is more of a local thing, but even still, you know, as a survivalist, the whole, you know, water is our most important resource. And the whole concept of not being allowed to store water just absolutely rubs me the wrong way. You know, like I store water here and I don't even have to. You know, I up here on the mountain, I've got a stream that runs literally a minute's walk from my house. And I've actually had to use that stream in the past. We have routinely power outages up here. When there's a storm, sometimes we lose the power for no particular reason. It just goes out, and sometimes it's back on in a couple of hours. Sometimes it's out for a whole day. It doesn't, you know, we don't have electricity until the next day. And I have water stored here, but I didn't want to use my drinking water to flush the toilet. And so, you know, when the power has gone out, there's one particular time. When it was out for more than a few hours, I went down the stream and, you know, with a 5 gallon bucket and scooped up some water from the stream, came back and used it to flush the toilet. And, you know, but if anything ever happened, if the grid went down or, you know, whatever, I'm working on, you know, I don't own my property here. I'm renting, and I have never owned, nor have I ever had a desire to own property. For two reasons. One being that I've lived a pretty itinerant lifestyle, which means that it's just a fancy word for saying like I like to move around a lot. You know, I've lived all over the country and I like to, you know, pick up and go, hey, let's check this place out for a while. I mean, I've been pretty I've pretty much been staying in the same area for the last few years, but hey, you know what? I might want to decide to go and, you know, move somewhere else. But the other reason is what I was just talking about earlier, is that you can't really ever own anything, you know, and it's always seemed to me like, hey, this is a great way for me to dump a lot of money into something that, you know, ultimately isn't really mine. It's the ownership is an illusion. And so, you know, people say, well, if you rent, then you're just throwing your money away and you don't have anything to show for it. Well, you know, that's debatable. All right. So between those two factors, it makes sense. And so I've always rented, and my landlord, long way around to describe the to explain this. I've had discussions with my landlord about installing a manual pump system or a solar system or generator. I mean, at the very least, it's a good idea to have a manual pump system if it'll work. And so that's in the works. But really, it's largely unnecessary. I mean, unless you're like really in love with having running water and you just can't live without it. I can live without it. I have lived without it. It's not a big deal to me. Like I said, I get a stream, just a few feet away that I get all my water from. I can get my drinking water from there. I got two ponds. One pond is a man-made pond, which is, it catches the runoff, the snow melt running off the mountain. And that water is completely fine. You'd have to process it, of course, filter it, boil it, get rid of the pathogens. And then there's a natural pond further down the mountain that, again, it's like, so we're blessed with an abundance of water out here, long story short. But, so to have somebody say, I've even mentioned having setting up a rain catchment system here too, but it seems kind of superfluous. But anyway, that's one of the things that I wanted to get off. And there's so many things. There's always so much news that infuriates me. But we're gonna have to take a quick break just for a minute, and we'll be right back. And I'm gonna bring you some more of the. More of the shocking news that's just demonstrating more and more that we're not living in a free country anymore. So just stick around, tell your friends, I'll be right back.
Survival is not about the end of the world. It's not about a hypothetical plane crash or the latest violent storm. Survival is about the satisfaction of knowing you can take care of yourself and your family in any situation, anytime, anywhere. CampingSurvival.com was started in 1956. No, not the .com part, the survival part. CampingSurvival.com has over 17,000 urban, wilderness, and preparedness items. Supreme customer service, very low shipping, and no games. We look around to make sure we have the lowest prices. And CampingSurvival.com is 100% USMC veteran-owned. Don't base your survival on the latest spring up on the internet company. Do business with an authority on survival. CampingSurvival.com. Confidence born on preparation.
Okay, and we're back at Survival and Beyond. And hey, the folks at Camping Survival wanted me to remind you folks that Okay, and we're back at Survival and Beyond, and hey, the folks over at Camping Survival wanted me to remind you that they are now carrying Mountain House in number 10 cans as well as pouches, so go and get yours today at CampingSurvival.com. And getting on with my next item of business here is the growing police state that's been going on, and this goes back a few months when I was talking about the militarization of our police here in this country. We can't have the military operating within the United States against the U.S. citizens because, God knows that they're way too busy making the world safe for democracy and bombing the hell out of everybody else. And we got another war coming up with Iran. A brand new executive order has been signed applying sanctions against Iran. Sanctions are an act of war. Sanctions have always precipitated war. That is what happened in World War II. People think that the Japanese just decided to attack Pearl Harbor just for the heck of it. No. Roosevelt was doing everything within his power to antagonize the Japanese people by applying sanctions. And this is what's happening now. Our Marxist in chief, our dictator through executive order, has signed another one to put the screws to Iran, and so you can look forward to that brand new war from our Peace Prize president. Yeah, he gets a Peace Prize, and then he bombs the hell out of three countries and perpetuates the war after promising, standing on a platform, an election platform, that he was gonna bring the troops back home and everything. And no, he hasn't reduced our wars at one bit. In fact, he's expanded. We're also looking at Syria now. But anyway, let's take it back home for a second. All right. We've got the militarized police force with all their brand nifty new gadgets and all their equipment and everything. The Anaheim police is rolling out there like the military, I want to say a SWAT team, but you know, it's beyond that. Not a word of it in the mainstream media. And DHS, it's now being reported they're gearing up. They're getting ready for the elections and also the Republican convention. And they're ordering all kinds of weapons and gear for that. And there's a report here from Russia Today. And you know what? Isn't it a shame that in this country we can't get the news that directly affects this country from our own media? We have to go to alternative sources like Russia Today and all these other online news sources that are not controlled by the corporate oligarchy, that are not lying to us, and either that or just omitting or, you know, not reporting what the powers that be don't want us to know. So from Russia Today, we get this report: DHS gears up for civil unrest prior to presidential elections. And you know what? I've been saying for a while, you know, I'm fully expecting something is going to happen, either right before the elections or during the elections. And this is just, you know, backing up my belief. Now, this is my belief. This is not anything that, you know, this is just my gut feeling. And I have a feeling just due to, you know, one thing is that a lot of people are, you know, don't want to see Obama reelected. And Romney is a joke. Romney's an idiot. I mean, that trip that he took, you know, he did this international trip. He goes to Poland, right? And what happens? The Polish people come out in support of Ron Paul. Now, I want to get to that a little later because I think that's really amusing. I mean, Romney's a puppet, okay? And there's no difference between Romney and Obama. And for all the people out there, and this is what really bothers me, and I mentioned this in my last show, you know, as far as like the public opinion and the comments that I'm seeing, you know, on these news stories and whatnot, where, you know, the Democrats and Republicans and, I mean, us, you know, we the people, you know, who are so mired and wrapped up in partisanship and their political party, you know, folks, it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't matter anymore. They're both the same. They're both two sides of the same coin. And you know, to see Americans slinging mud at each other, you know, because you're a Democrat, you're, you know, liberal, left-hard, and whatnot, and well, let's face it, they are. They're clueless. You know, if you're a liberal, and you're not gonna like what anything that I have to say. Okay, you're gonna get upset about everything I have to say because you're brainwashed. You're zombies. You don't, you know, you can't see. And I'm not saying that Republicans, you know, like, I am not a Republican. I'm a conservative, and I just don't like labels. I've never applied labels to myself. I believe in liberty. And I guess the closest thing you could say, if you really needed to pigeonhole me and put me in a box, is that I'm a libertarian, but I'm not even, you know, 100% on board with that. I'm an American, okay? I'm a constitutionalist. And you really, like I said last week, and I think it bears repeating, you got to stop this. We got to stop fighting with each other over petty issues of partisanship. Stop thinking of yourself as an American. I mean, stop thinking of yourself as a Democrat or as a Republican. Start thinking of yourself as an American. Wake up and smell the pizza, folks. get hip to what's going on, because this has nothing to do with whether, you know, you happen to be a Democrat or a Republican. It has more to do with being liberal and conservative, but still, you know, forget about whatever party dogma that you adhere to. It's nonsense. We gotta stop fighting with each other so that we can fight the real enemy, and that's the takeover and the usurpation of our Constitution, and those who would make us slaves, those who would take our rights away from us as they are being taken away from us on a daily basis. You know, so anyway, I want to read some of this report here. The Department of Homeland Security has ordered masses of riot gear equipment to prepare for potential significant domestic riots at the Republican National Convention. Republican National Convention, the Democratic National Convention, and next year's presidential inauguration. The DHS submitted a rush solicitation to the Federal Business Opportunity Site on Wednesday, which is a portal for federal government procurement requisitions over $25,000. The request gave the potential suppliers only one day to submit their proposals and a 15-day delivery requirement to Alexandria, Virginia. As the brief explains, the objective of this effort is to procure riot gear to prepare for the 2012 Democratic and Republican National Conventions, the 2013 presidential inauguration, and other future similar activities. Now, the riot gear will be worn by Federal Protection Service agents who are tasked with protecting property, grounds, and buildings owned by federal governments. The urgency of the order can be explained by the fact that there is a growing anticipation that many demonstrators will travel to the Republican National Convention, scheduled for August 27th through the 30th in Tampa Bay, Florida, and Democratic National Convention planned for September 3rd through 6th in Charlotte, North Carolina. The RNC, for example, will have free speech zones. Oh, and this is another thing that I really love. Free speech. What the hell is a free speech zone? You know what? I thought all of America was a free speech zone. I thought the Constitution guaranteed that we have freedom of speech, period. It doesn't say freedom of speech and assembly in a free speech zone or in a pre-designated area. You know, this whole, and the free speech zones that they put protesters in, they might as well put them on the moon, because they say, all right, well, here, you can stand here like 3 miles away from where everything's happening. You know, we're going to, you know, protest it where nobody's going to, we're going to let you protest where nobody's going to see you, you know. So they're going to have free speech zones, which will serve as containment quarters for the protesters by not allowing them to leave the designated area and cause trouble. Another recent DHS move to gear up was back in March of this year, when it gave the defense contractor ATK a deal to provide the DHS with 450 million 40 caliber hollow point ammunition over a 5-year period. And I've covered this on the show before. I think that's pretty much well-known news. We don't need to go into too much detail about that. But yeah, they're gearing up. Some of the stuff that DHS is looking to obtain are riot helmets, upper body shoulder protection, thigh and groin protection, shin guards, substantial protection from flying debris, non-ballistic weapons, blah, 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 forearm protection, tactical gloves, you know, riot gear. You know, so, yeah, get ready. If you're going down to the Republican National Convention or the Democratic National Convention, whichever party you happen to belong to, get ready for the riot gear. Get ready for the riot police, because that's what you're going to be looking at. They're going to have checkpoints and all that great stuff. And this ties in with another story also about DHS, that they're claiming the drones now, that this is for public safety. Now, remember what I said? Remember what I always say? Anything that has the word safety attached to it coming from the government is a ruse. It has nothing to do with your safety. You know, I'm suspicious anytime I hear anything the government, DHS, whoever, saying, oh, this is for public safety. So we're going to have 30,000 surveillance drones, and they're supposed to be keeping us safe, right? They're already using, I'll read from the story here, the report. The United States already uses surveillance drones on its borders, but Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, big sis Janet, all right, if you see something, say something. Well, I see something every time I see her, and so, you know, I'm saying something. Janet Napolitano said during a hearing on Wednesday that flying unmanned aircraft inside the U.S. could be the next step to ensuring public safety. Any explanation as to why? Why are surveillance drones keeping us safe? Secretary Napolitano weighed in on the topic of unmanned aerial vehicles during this week's Committee on Homeland Security and suggested that implementing UAVs for domestic surveillance could be the next step, amazingly accelerating drone program. The Federal Aviation Administration is currently considering ground rules that will outline how the FAA can govern domestic drone use, and by 2020, they expect to see 30,000 UAVs soaring through U.S. airspace. You know what? I think it's going to be a lot sooner than 2020. I think it's going to be a heck of a lot sooner than 2020. Speaking before a House panel on Wednesday, though, Secretary Napolitano suggested that deploying UAVs proactively to put an extra set over locales nowhere near America's borders may in fact be the next move. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're going to have drones over at the Canadian border as well. Now, I don't know why we need to be kept safe from the Canadians. You know, are they expecting a Canadian invasion? They expect, what is there, like 3 million people in Canada? You know, so we have to have, that's further down here. With respect to science and technology, that directorate, we do have a funded project, she said, and I think it's California. Looking at drones that could be utilized to give us substantial awareness in a large public safety matter or disaster, such as a forest fire, or how they could give us better information. In a transcript of the secretary's testimony made available after her address, Napolitano admits that the U.S. has expanded their use of surveillance drones on America's borders with Canada in recent years, now letting UAVs monitor 950 miles of Washington state's boundary line. Now, you know, it's funny when they mention that this is for our safety, because these things are not even safe, you know? These are flying robots. These are flying remote control robots, all right? They crash. In fact, one of them's crashed recently right in Washington. Despite growing opposition from the American public of drones, largely centered over privacy objections, the United States has continuously ramped up its drone program in recent years, both domestically and abroad. During the Hackers on Planet Earth conference in New York City earlier this month, activists with Electronic Frontier Foundation said that U.S. military now owns around 7,500 drones, which makes up about one-third of the Air Force's entire arsenal. The FAA can give drone licenses to any agency that can prove that they can use them safely. The EFF's Trevor Tim told the crowd, despite dozens of permits being handed out to law enforcement agencies and educational institutions in recent years, neither the security nor safety of these aircraft are believed to have been fully examined. In just the last few weeks, a Texas professor hacked a UAV in front of representatives from DHS, and separately, a military drone crash-landed just outside of Washington, D.C. Yeah. Now imagine 30,000 of these things flying around. You know, I think the FAA has enough trouble keeping commercial airliners and, you know, keeping air traffic straightened out, keeping that stuff from keeping planes from crashing into each other. Let alone when they get 30,000 frickin' flying robots to contend with. Now, despite these incidences, the FAA and DHS are still spearheading an accelerated drone program, given Secretary Napolitano's latest statements. Though the domestic use of drones for proactive surveillance could be coming sooner than previously thought. Uh-huh. Yep. You can bet it's coming sooner than previously thought. Right now, all they're doing is they're getting the American people used to the idea. And again, the complacent, sheepish masses are going to be like, shrug your shoulders. It's for our safety. It's supposed to be stopping terrorists or Canadian terrorists? What's the deal? They're going to be flying all over. I can't even get the words out. I mean, if this doesn't infuriate you, if this does not remind you of Nazi Germany, then I don't know what to do with you. I don't know how to explain this any better. I don't know if somebody needs to slap some smarts into you. If you're going to shrug and you're going to accept this, I mean, and that's the problem, is that every time these things are implemented, every time these things are forced on the American people, people accept it because, they still believe in the terrorist threat. You know what would really end terrorism? If we didn't have a foreign policy of going in and just running roughshod over countries, governments, people, you can go to the Middle East and find out how many people are thrilled about the fact that America has been keeping them safe, and the drone attacks that they're having over there. If you don't think that they're not going to use drones against us, if you don't think that they're not going to arm these drones, first of all, even if they didn't arm the drones, if they were just spy cameras and whatnot, that is such an abhorrent infraction of the Constitution and our freedom. Just like Judge Napolitano, no relation, said that the first person who shoots down a surveillance drone over their house in American airspace will become an American folk hero. And you know what? I agree with them. The only way that this is going to be overcome is if people are aware and people are willing to stand up and say something about it. And that's why I always say, I've said frequently on my show, if you're concerned, if you're a brother in arms, if you're a patriot, if you're a constitutionalist and you stand for freedom, you stand for liberty, then you got to stand up and say something about it. You got to do something about it. Start your own show, start a website, a blog, whatever. The more voices out there, the more the word is going to spread. You're gonna start a fire of freedom. You're gonna start a fire in the minds and hearts of everybody who hears you. And maybe not everybody. You'll still have the leftards, the liberals, the Obama apologists, the people who are willing and happy with their enslavement. Those people you may not be able to reach, but you'll reach some of them. And those of us who already have the ideals and the principles of liberty and freedom and the Constitution and what America is supposed to stand for, and people who want to reduce the government, people who know that the Constitution is not here to give power to the government, is to give power to the people, people who know that and believe in the ideals of what this country was founded on, you got to do something. You got to say something. Getting back to the see something, say something. Well, I see tyranny, and so I'm saying something about it. And I'm not going to shut up just because I'm afraid that DHS might be listening to me, or now that we got NDAA, you can be arrested and detained just out of suspicion of being a terrorist. I am not a terrorist. I'm a free American citizen, and I'm not alone. And speaking of NDAA, I don't want to forget about this. I got contacted earlier today by Dan Johnson, who is the founder of PANDA, People Against National Defense Authorization Act. And he wanted me to spread the word and tell you folks about PANDA, and also that they have a campaign going to join PANDA. They have set December 31st, 2013, as their projected date of doing away with PANDA altogether. And you can read more about it. I won't go into too much detail. I'm running kind of short on time. There's one other thing I wanted to bring to you. But go to their website, and that's www.peopleagainstnda.com/joinus. And This is a great way to get active and stand up against tyranny, because that is what the National Defense Authorization Act is. Straight up, pure and simple tyranny. And you're not alone. If you're a patriot, you love liberty, you love America, you love your freedom, you are not alone. And this is a great way to get active. So go to that site, www.peopleagainstndaa.com/join us, and sign up, check it out, find out what PANDA is all about. Now, I'm going to leave you with one, what I think is kind of amusing, an amusing story. It's Mitt Romney, the idiot pretender to the throne. It took a little trip, and one of the stops in his itinerary was Poland. And boy, man, you know, it's like I had great respect for the Polish people. You know, the Polish don't take any guff, man. I mean, they stood up to the Nazis, they stood up to the Soviets, they stood for their freedom. Sometimes I think the Polish people probably know more about liberty and freedom than we do here in the United States, and that's not. It's not a denigrating remark. I don't mean that insultingly, but they don't put up with the stuff. You know, when they found out that the bees were being killed by GMO corn, you know, they got active. They got organized. They got together. They got GMOs banned from their country. We can't do that in America for some reason. I don't know why. You know, this is America, man. This is what freedom's all about. But Mitt Romney goes to Poland, right? And a mass of Polish Ron Paul supporters came out with a huge sign and everything. And I wanted to play for you this this interview that was conducted by Fox News. Give credit where credit's due. And interviewing one of the Polish Ron Paul supporters. So check this out.
Sir, what's your name?
Artur Dziambor.
And why, you are for Ron Paul?
Well, exactly. In Poland, there is a party that is called the Right Wing Congress, and this is like exactly the same that Ron Paul says in America. The same things that Ron Paul says in America, it's the same thing in Poland.
All right. Well, you came out today. Is that because Governor Romney is here?
Well, yeah, we came out here just to say hello, and to tell him that we're not interested in his candidacy. We are interested in Ron Paul and in what he says, because he is the one that really makes a difference. He's the one that says about our troops coming back to Poland and not dying with American troops out there. And he is the only one that says about the visas problem, because this is something that is very distracting for us. You know, Polish people have to go and ask for the opportunity to go to the USA to have a trip. And this is awful for us. And Ron Paul says about demolishing the system, not changing or altering it anyway. He's just saying about completely destroying it. And this is what we think should be done.
What about President Obama?
Well, we are completely against President Obama. President Obama is a socialist. In Poland, he would be even called a communist.
And what influence do you think you'll have supporting Ron Paul here? You can't vote in the U.S., right?
Well, we can vote in the U.S., but we can show people.
Can you vote in the U.S.? Are you American?
No. I'm Polish. And, okay. And you know, we can show people, ask people to watch Ron Paul on YouTube. There are like dozens and hundreds of movies with Ron Paul's words and with the subtitles in Polish, so we can get to know what his ideas are. You know, there are no differences between Obama and Romney in reality, but there is a huge difference between Ron Paul and everybody.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
So you see, even in other parts of the world, other countries can see, you know, what's going on here, and they can smell what Ron Paul's cooking, and they believe in what he's talking about, and they can't even vote for him. I mean, I love that. That was hilarious when she said, "Oh, can you vote for Ron Paul?" I don't know who the reporter was, but you know, that was just idiotic. Yeah, he can vote. Yeah, people in other countries can vote in the American elections. That's, you know, that was brilliant. But yeah, I mean, they support what Ron Paul is saying so much that, you know, they're going out and they have like an organization that supports the guy. I mean, and you know, and going out to show their support to Mitt Romney, and you know, and all of the Romney team, you know, the Romney supporters, I don't know if they're his entourage or whatever, but his his campaign workers were going out and trying to obscure their banner. They had a huge banner with a picture of Ron Paul and everything. I mean, it's this really long banner, and they were trying to obscure it by holding umbrellas up and trying to block it so the press, you know, in a vain attempt to try to obscure it from the press, from the photographers, and just brilliant, man, just brilliant. I thought that was awesome, you know, and that's what we need. I mean, we need more people here. We need the sheeple here to wake up to what's going on. And you know what? I don't care anymore. You know, Ron Paul's not over. He's not. You know, I mean, Mitt Romney may be the presumptive nominee, the Republican nominee, but you know, I think if everybody, you know, it's been said before, if everybody who said that Ron Paul has no chance of being elected would just vote for him, then he would be elected. He would write his name in. I don't care. You know, I was concerned, and I'm still a little concerned about you know, about the election, because Mitt Romney's not even supported by the Republicans, you know, and he just doesn't have what it takes, and he doesn't has what it takes to doesn't have what it takes to beat Obama, and I'm kind of concerned that you know, if the vote is split, and you know, but you know what, I'm voting for Ron Paul. And if you're a Ron Paul supporter, do not switch to Romney, because you're gonna get something that's worse than Obama. If not exactly the same, it might be worse. He's a big supporter of a big military. You're just gonna, if you like war, if you like to you know, want to get into more and more wars, then go ahead and switch tracks to Mitt Romney. But I'm telling you what, it's a mistake. It's a mistake, and I'm not. I can't, with any good conscience, vote for either of them. I don't vote the party line. But anyway, I'm not going to tell you what to do, because you're a free person. You are a free, sovereign human being. You're a free American, and I can't tell you what to do. I can just tell you what I'm going to do. So anyway, we're getting pretty close to a break here, and so when we come back, we're going to be talking to Scott B. Williams, and he's a good friend of mine. He's been on the show before, and he's a prolific writer, and he's going to be here talking about his latest novel. Yes, he's written a novel, a work of fiction, his very first work of fiction, and I've been reading it, and it's pretty darn swell. It's called The Pulse, and the full title is The Pulse, a novel of surviving the collapse of the grid. And so he's going to be here. He's going to be talking about that, and we're going to be talking about a few other things. You know, he's written several other books, non-fiction books, like Bug Out, most notably, and Bug Out Vehicles and Shelters. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back talking to Scott B. Williams. Don't forget, check out Panda. I've had Dan on my show before. You can check that out in the archives, and join up with Panda, check out what they're all about, and we'll be right back in just a couple minutes here on Natural News Radio and Prepper Podcast Radio Network. Stick around, I'll be right back.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com, or download the MP3 archive files and listen on your phone or personal computer. And when you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com, with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Raw Nation's Hot Rocks is the only raw, vegan, certified organic vitamin for your sex drive. Hot Rocks is made using only the purest organic superfoods and herbs in their raw, unaltered state. We've created this synergistic blend of powerful herbs that intensifies sexual energy and performance in both men and women. It's like an overall vitality pill that makes you feel amazing. There's absolutely no chemicals, pesticides, or harsh stimulants in Hot Rocks. If you already have a strong sex drive, Hot Rocks will help you maintain it and keep it from slipping away. The problem that affects even the healthiest people nowadays because of the amount of toxicity that we are all exposed to. So what are you waiting for? We offer a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can order Hot Rocks risk-free. It's time to experience pure bliss and the only truly healthy libido enhancer on the market, Hot Rocks. Order online at hotrocks.com. That's HOTRAWKS.com. Or call us 855-RAW-LIFE. That's 855-729-5433.
Friends, I just did my annual economic briefing with author and Swiss America chairman Craig R. Smith, and what I discovered confirms my worst fears. Something is getting ready to happen that's going to change the course of world history, and not one in a thousand will believe it until it's already too late, and I don't want that to be you. After writing four important books accurately predicting the future of gold, oil, the dollar, and inflation, Mr. Smith is on the verge of releasing his next book, and this new CD covers the root issue of the coming crisis and offers three critical steps to protect your family from the fallout. Please call today for this hot new CD, The Future of Money. Toll free, 888-559-9920, 888-559-9920. You've got to hear The Future of Money to believe it. 888-559-9920, 888-559-9920. Do it today.
Okay, and we're back, and you're listening to Survival and Beyond, and I'm your host, Ed Corcoran. And on the show today, it's good to have our friend Scott B. Williams back on the program. And he's the author of Bug Out and Bug Out Vehicles and Shelters, as well as several other books on his adventures in sea kayaking and all kinds of outdoors. What the fuck am I doing? Okay, and we're back, and you're listening to Survival and Beyond, and today on the show, I'm your host, Ed Corcoran, and today on the show, it's good to have our good friend Scott B. Williams back on the program, and he's the author of Bug Out and Bug Out Vehicles and Shelters, as well as several other books, and today he's here to talk about his new novel, his first foray into the world of fiction, and it's called The Pulse, a novel of surviving the collapse of the grid. And, well, without any further delay, let's welcome Scott back to the show. How you doing, Scott?
Great, Ed. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's always great to have you on the show, and boy, you're one prolific writer, I'll tell you what. I mean, it doesn't seem like too long ago we had you on the show talking about your other book, your nonfiction book, Bug Out Vehicles and Shelters, and today we're going to be talking about your novel, and this is your first foray into fiction, as I understand.
Yes, it is. It's actually the first novel that I've written. I've dabbled in fiction a lot back before. I did even my nonfiction books, but never really completed a novel. I just wanted to write fiction for a long time, and then kind of got off in another direction and did the nonfiction books, seven nonfiction books before this one. But I really enjoy the process of creating fiction because it is, actually more creative, the whole thing, just starting from nothing and making a story.
Yeah, I was really interested to read it and to see how you handled the transition from nonfiction into a novel and actually creating the story and everything, and it's been a good read so far. I haven't quite completed it yet. I'm still reading it, but I'm still turning the pages.
Yeah, that's good. I just as long as you're still turning pages, I guess it's okay then. That's the point, kind of keep you going to the end. But writing fiction, I have a lot of real-life experiences to draw on, and a lot of these experiences really don't translate over very well to nonfiction books. I mean, so many different things that I've done that I wanted to incorporate in books, and in my writing and fiction provides an outlet for that, just like a lot of the failing, parts of this book, something I enjoy writing about.
Right. And yeah, you do have a extensive experience in sailing, kayaking. You're like a hardcore kayaker. But before we go any further, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the book, what the premise is, and what the storyline is all about?
Well, it's an apocalyptic fiction, you know, type book. So, you know, it's basically the premise is that there's a big solar flare, EMP, you know, a natural solar flare, EMP. So you've got a father who is off on vacation in the Caribbean. This guy is a doctor, you know, by profession, and he's not experienced sailor by any means, but he's off in the Caribbean visiting his brother, who is a professional delivery skipper who moves sailboats around from place to place for other people, for the owners. So Artie, the main character, the father, is down in the islands with his brother on board the boat, and they're out at sea on a passage between two islands when the solar flare occurs in the middle of the night. And all their electronics, you know, kind of goes haywire there. There's a minor flare that causes, you know, communications to fail. And then, you know, in a series of events over the next few hours, everything is shut down completely. So they're out at sea, and they really don't know what happened. They're limited to their perspective, what they can see from where they are, and they just have to guess how extensive it is. But Artie has a teenage daughter who is in her second year of college at Tulane University in New Orleans, and that's his biggest concern is, you know, whether or not this has affected her and how he's going to communicate with her now, because he was already cut off just by being on the boat and had not been able to talk to her for a few days, and now he's really, really concerned, you know, that when he gets to St. Thomas, where their destination is, that he's not going to be able to get in touch with her, and that proves to be true when they get there. And then, and of course, that's the opening storyline. And then the other storyline is the story of Casey, Artie's daughter, and her roommate Jessica, and how they're perceiving the situation from New Orleans, you know, being in the city. When the grid goes down, you know, she wakes up in the morning to go to class, and everything is shut down, and they have to deal with, you know, what they're going to do. Of course, they're pretty well clueless. You know, they're, you know, your typical college student, you know, the, you know, urban type you know, young women, and they're, you know, they're not survivalists by any means. None of the characters in the book are. But Casey does have a friend, Grant, who's a graduate student who has been there during Katrina, and he knows what's going to happen, you know, from his experiences with Katrina. He knows it's not going to be safe, especially with this much more widespread grid down event. So it becomes up to him. I mean, he talks them into leaving with him to get out of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the premise is set up. Mm-hmm. You got two storylines there.
Yeah, and you know, there's a couple things that I really like about the premise of the book, and one is that you choose a solar flare as the catalytic event, or as the catastrophic event. It's not an economic collapse. It's not a, you know, nuclear attack or anything like really, you know, apocalyptic or anything like that. And the reason why I like that as the crux of the story is that this is something that I've felt as it gets very little attention, the possibility of having a grid collapse as a result of a solar flare. This is something that really it's meaningful to me, because many years ago, before I even started thinking about any kind of societal collapse or you know, anything like that, that was my first my first introduction into something that could happen to society that would utterly collapse it, that nobody really thinks about. I mean, by and large, I think most people, when they think about a grid crash, they think, oh, well, so what? We'll just have to, you know, read by candlelight, you know, and we'll just break out the lanterns and the flashlights and, you know, nothing much more beyond that would happen. And very few people take the time to realize all of the domino effect and all the ramifications that a world without electricity will create or bring into our existence. And it is it's not a big flash bang devastating event. It's something that, you know, people will be scratching their heads for a couple of days, and then the next thing you know, things will just continually get worse and worse and worse. And that's something. And also the fact that we are entering into a solar maximum, the end of 2012 into 2013 is going to be one of the most active solar periods on record, and there is a very real threat of a solar flare induced EMP event.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this has been in the news a lot, you know, lately, lots of attention, you know, to the possibility of solar flare. But if any, you know, no matter what causes the grid to go down, you know, one of the main, I guess, if the novel has a theme to it, you know, the main theme is that people are just so dependent on high technology, you know, advanced technology, and, you know, especially here in the United States, and that's the whole point, you know, of the book really is how dependent people are on all these things that, that make everything work like one big smooth oil machine, you know, but if you take away the power, it's all going to come apart, and it's going to come apart fast, and when it does, the reaction, you know, the way people are going to react to that is going to make it even more dangerous, you know, for everyone, the people that are prepared as well as those that are not. So it would be, I think it would be quite devastating, and one can only imagine how much, and, you know, and that's, you know, of course, in a fictional work, you can paint a picture, you know, and that's what I did, the way I would imagine it. And a lot of this is based on what I saw in the very area that's portrayed in the novel, you know, what I saw after Katrina right here in the same area, South Louisiana and South Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So, and that was a very, you know, localized event. I mean, the grid was down, you know, in most of the southern half of Mississippi and Louisiana, probably, you know, for a few weeks in a lot of places, but still, you know, neighboring states still had their power and supplies, and you had the utility crews coming in from all over America, you know, to help, and you had security people coming in, and, you know, order was restored, you know, fairly fast, but imagine if it's so widespread, where's that help going to come from?
Right, yeah, absolutely, and it's obviously in your book, it is a widespread event. I mean, one of the main characters, Artie, he's heading towards the Virgin Islands, and, you know, they're wondering, it's like, well, is it just here? Well, they find out it's also in Puerto Rico, and then in the meantime, his daughter Casey and her roommate are dealing with the same thing, wondering, you know, like, well, you know, is it just here in New Orleans or is it elsewhere? And that's going to be, you know, when there is, or if there is an event, I should say, if there is a grid crash like that, that is widespread. I mean, it's going to take a while for people to start to realize how dire the situation really is. It's going to be really, I think, most of the population, they're going to be slow to react to it. It's going to take, you know, a couple of days before people start realizing, oh, hey, wait a minute, where's the food going to come from? Oh, hey, wait a minute, you know, like, where's, you know, like, you made reference to, you know, all the cars that were disabled, and then there were a few people who still had older cars that didn't have any electronics in it, and you mentioned, I think you referred to them as being one of the lucky ones who had an older car, but then they were, their luck's going to run out because they're going to run out of gas, and there's no way that they can replenish their fuel. And there are just so many little subtle things that people just don't think about, and I think it's really great that you chose this as a premise and kind of, you know, woke people up to this. I know it was an awakening for me when I started, you know, it was a documentary, and my listeners have heard me mention this before, what really started to wake me up in terms of, you know, grid collapse was this documentary where they went step by step through all of the stages that, you know, our society will go through after the grid goes down.
Right. Yeah, and I think, it's hard to say, like you said, you know, how fast these things are going to unfold and how fast society is going to really collapse, but you know, I may have accelerated it a little bit there in New Orleans, but I think the two things that are going to be, you know, the fact, as you mentioned, that, you know, most vehicles are not going to run, you know, that's going to make people really sit up and pay notice. You know, this is not just an ordinary, you know, this is not the utility company or something. This is something different, you know. I mean, people are going to realize that it's not an ordinary blackout-type situation when all these other things are affected as well. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that they're going to be, you know, no matter where you are, in the United States or in the islands, you know, in the book, you're not going to know much beyond your immediate area. I mean, there's not going to be any way of getting news if all, you know, all the power's down or communication's down. Very few people are going to have a way to get news of the outside area, you know, because they can't get there. There's not many people traveling quickly. So there's going to be a lot of, you know, people are going to be in the dark, but literally and, you know, the other way as far as not knowing what's going on. So a lot of confusion, I think, which is going to lead to chaos quickly.
Right, right. Yeah, chaos and looting. And I'm just about at the point in the book where where Artie and his brother and Scully get attacked by the three islanders. You know, they with machetes while they're trying to get their boat together and get it out in the water. Right. And then, you know, there's also in the meantime over in New Orleans, you know, the kids get confronted by a couple of thugs in the street who want their bicycles. And they're riding, they're planning, I don't want to give away too much of the story. This, I think, is still pretty much in the foreshadowing stages, but, you know, they're trying to get to a cabin, get out of the city and everything like that. And, sure. Yeah, it didn't really take too long. And that's one of the things I'm thinking about. It's like, yeah, how would I find out what the heck is going on with, you know, the satellites are out, the there's no television, there's no news. And, you know, it's an eerie feeling when you imagine yourself being in that situation and just having no way of knowing. And these people, like, as you mentioned, they're not survivalists. These aren't, you know, this isn't like, you know, a gung-ho ex-Marine, hoorah, you know, you know, busting down the barricades kind of characters. You know, they're just regular folks who never gave a thought to this before in their lives. And you really put the reader in the minds or in the mindset, I guess, of these people. And you almost want to, you know, say, hey, dummy, this, get out of here, do this and everything. But there, you have to let them come to their own realizations after a while. And they realize, you know, like you and I, you know, lights go out. We're like, boom, we know exactly what to do. We know the gear to grab, where to go, where we're going to bug out to and everything like that. But they're still having to sort things out for themselves. And I think that really makes it compelling.
Yeah, and then you're going to have the people like the one girl's boyfriend, Joey, you know, who's just wondering, you know, where's the next cold beer coming from, you know, they haven't figured out there's a problem yet, you know, and there's going to be a lot of people like that, too, you know, but you know, I have the one character, Larry, you know, Artie's brother, who's the sailor. Of course, he's been living on boats and traveling, so he does pretty well, you know, because he's already adapted to, you know, to living off the grid to some extent, so... You know, if you have you know, a character like that, and then Grant does have some experience camping, and he's traveled in the jungles, you know, doing these research trips because he's an anthropology major, so he knows how to camp and canoe and things like that. So you got just a little bit, you know, a little bit of experience there to help him get through it. But I did not want to write a book, you know, like you're saying, that portrays, you know, some ex-Navy SEAL type guy that's just a superhero that can do everything, you know. I mean, I like to read some of those kind of stories, too, but I wanted to write a story about just mostly ordinary people caught in a really extraordinary circumstance and how they might get out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned Joey. I couldn't wait for that guy to get rid of it.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, so what? The power will be back on in a couple of days. What's the big deal? Where's my beer? Where's my Coors Light? You know, and I'm like, this guy's a jerk. I hope he doesn't stick around too much longer.
I may bring him back in the sequel, you know.
I don't think Joey's survival chances are looking too good.
Right. Right. But yeah, you know, I enjoyed writing the story about the, you know, these kind of people and just how they would all, you know, the possibilities of things that they could do, and you could go in a lot of different directions with a story like this, of course, you know. But, I thought it would be a logical thing to have the you know, the two girls heading out of town with this older friend that does have the possibility of a place that they can stay, you know, a cabin or a camp on the river. Those are really common around here in South Mississippi and Louisiana, you know, these river camps where people go for the weekend, and most people do keep generators, and even though they're not preppers or survivalists, you know, they have a lot of supplies on hand and the stuff that they would need to stay out there for a long time, and they're off the grid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something a lot of people would do in this area.
And obviously, you set this in New Orleans. You know, this was a deliberate decision, and the characters, or at least Grant, who was there, you know, for Hurricane Katrina and everything, and saw everything that happened. I mean, that's a, you know, good insight to have right there. I mean, he is basically having to explain to Casey, you know, like, well, these are the kind of things that you can expect to happen. And,
right.
And, you know, and I had to think, you know, I couldn't help but think about, if this did happen, you know, I think the people who have already gone through a situation where, you know, they have to go without power, a real devastating cataclysmic event and everything, they would be better suited if something like this happened, because they could apply the things that they learned from Katrina and from previous hurricanes and disasters and everything. And what was that? Was it a deliberate? Did you deliberately set them? Because I was kind of on the fence. I was thinking, I don't know. Maybe I would have set it somewhere where, you know, like nobody had ever had to go through any kind of cataclysm like that, like Katrina before. But I think it's a good thing that you did set it there, because at least, you know, that character Grant does have that experience.
Yeah, I think you're right. That the people that have been through that experience, they are probably much more prepared today than they were, you know, 6 years ago when Katrina came through. I mean, it's still, you know, or 7 years, I should say now, but, people are going to have more supplies on hand because they know how bad it can be and what it's like, you know, to give them all about power. But, it was a deliberate decision to set it in New Orleans, mainly because I wanted to write about areas that I'm really familiar with, you know, especially where they go when they leave New Orleans, the rivers. Some of these places are, you know, rivers that I've spent, you know, weeks and weeks canoeing and camping, and, you know, you'll see the descriptions of the swamps and all when you get more. I know you're not to that part yet in the book, but I wanted to write about that kind of setting, you know, that place setting, and that's where the conclusion of the book wraps up.
I'm kind of wishing that I had a chance to read the entire book, because now I want to ask too many questions that are potentially spoilers.
Right.
Like, so how does it end? So do they survive? Do they make it out alive? But there is going to be a sequel, so.
Yeah, I think there will be a sequel, maybe. I've had a lot of people comment about that, and I did leave the ending in such a way that it naturally kind of leads to a sequel, so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just don't know exactly which direction I'll go with that, but the story itself, you know, I mean, the premise lends itself to all sorts of other possibilities, of course, because you've already got the grid of going down, you know, and then you get the setting, so, most likely there will be.
When you decided to write a novel, one of the things that I like about the novel is, you know, we were talking about this earlier off the air, is that, you know, you can write all the survival guides that you want and all these books, and there's just always going to be, you're already preaching to the choir, more or less. You're already talking to people who are interested in survival and prepping. But with a novel, I mean, this really speaks to the non-prepper, the non-survivalist, and it really, I think it does a great job of getting a message out there that, like, hey, wake up. Look, you know, dummy, this is a very real possibility, and I think that it will really reach a lot of people and spread awareness among people who probably would never even give a second thought about a grid collapse or about any kind of prepping or survival situation at all.
That's exactly right. I mean, my books like Bug Out and Bug Out Vehicle, you know, they're pretty narrow focused, and, you know, they're focused to people that are already familiar with the terms and prepping, and, I mean, they've been popular, you know, in that community of people, but, you know, if I show this to, say, one of my own, you know, distant cousins or friends that really don't know what all this stuff's about, and they look at it, it's like, what is all this, you know, we need this kind of information. I mean, you know, they just, it's pretty out there to a lot of people, but on the other hand, they can read this novel, and they can, you know, then the light bulb goes off, and they can kind of see how this all ties together, and they see why I wrote the other books now, more or less. And I wanted to write a novel that would reach, you know, just the general reader and be entertaining to the general reader, which is another reason why I didn't make the characters these super expert prepping type heroes. You know, I wanted to have just ordinary people that the ordinary reader could relate to.
Yeah.
And actually picture themselves in the story. You know, I think this is a book that, like you said before, you could picture yourself in this situation, and what would you do?
Right.
I mean, there's times when you want to say, you know, dummy, do this. You know, you know, from their point of view, you know, they're living the story from their point of view and what's going on and what they can see from their perspective of it. You know, so.
Right. Yeah, and you didn't have you're not going into a lot of jargon or a lot of lingo or a lot of stuff that, you know, the average person either, you know, wouldn't know or probably might have a hard time getting through, you know.
Right. And I may have done a little bit with the sailing. I mean, I know there's some, you know, technical jargon and stuff in the sailing passages, but, you know, most people, I think most readers like to, even if they aren't familiar with a specific thing like that, I think they like to maybe learn, you know, something new when they read a book like that. I know I do, so hopefully
right.
Too much.
Yeah, I don't know much about sailing myself. I'm pretty much I'm a mountain man, you know. I'm a land-based guy. And the sailing terminology didn't really throw me. However, there was one thing a question that popped in my head I was not aware that you could have an autopilot on a sailing vessel.
Oh yeah, you can have and the autopilot I described there is an electronic type autopilot that can they make different kinds. It can connect to either a tiller, you know, which is just a stick that connects to the rudder, you know, on the most simple sailing vessels, and then some, you know, most of the bigger vessels have a wheel steering, you know, arrangement, like a wheel on a pedestal. And the autopilot, it has, you know, little servo motors in it, and you dial it in on the compass course that you want to sail, or point your boat in the direction you want to sail, and what it does is it keeps it within, say, 5 degrees to the port and starboard of that course that you set. So it does keep the boat corrected, and it works even when the engine's not running, you know, because it works off the ship's batteries, you know, which could be off of 12, you know, solar panels or whatever. So even on long ocean passages, you can use, you know, an electronic autopilot to steer your boat without having to run the engine. So, yeah, they're very common on boats, but most offshore voyagers that are going, like, around the world or across whole oceans use either a combination of the electronic autopilot and a wind vane or exclusively a wind vane, which is a mechanical device that works. It's got a vane that you set in relation to the wind, and it keeps the boat on course. So that's the most reliable system, you know, if you were going to, you know, especially after the grid goes down. And that's what I mentioned in part of the book where they're actually sailing towards the mainland. They have the wind vane on the catamaran.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I always imagine like on a sailing ship, on a schooner, that you really needed to have humans, you know, and forgive me, I don't know the terminology, but you know, like, you know, unfurling the mainsails and, you know, and working the ropes and everything like that. So that was kind of interesting. And
well, steering is the least desirable job on a vessel. You know, I mean, anybody can tell you, anybody that's been offshore very much will tell you that, you know, no one wants to steer. You know, you take somebody out new, you know, the first time sailing, oh, yeah, man, I get to steer the boat, and you can always get people to steer for you, you know, if you take them out sailing. But get them out there for 3 weeks on a passage, and nobody wants to sit there and steer, you know, for 4 hours at a time or whatever duration of the watch, you know. So it's very boring, and, you know, there's no need to do it by hand, you know, because, as I say, you can do the mechanical or electronic steering devices.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break right now. Just be 1 minute, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Scott B. Williams, author of The Pulse.
Preparing yourself for an emergency doesn't have to be all about doom and gloom. Getting all worked up about an impending disaster isn't going to better prepare you. It's just going to stress you out. Here at survival-gear.com, we believe your main goal when putting together a survival kit is to not just have the critical items you need in order to stay alive, but the right supplies in sufficient quantity to shield you from the effects of an extended unfortunate event. I like to say that if you have to use your survival kit, it should seem more like an impromptu camping trip rather than a dire emergency. Likewise, if a hurricane, earthquake, or tornado make your home unusable, you want to be able to set up camp and still be relatively comfortable. Even during a survival scenario, staying warm, dry, hydrated, and fed doesn't have to seem like roughing it. At survival-gear.com, our goal is to better prepare you by providing full-fledged survival kits that you can absolutely count on. Visit survival-gear.com and check out our premium line of survival kits.
Okay, and we're back, and you're listening to Survival and Beyond. And our guest today is Scott B. Williams, and he's the author of Bug Out Vehicles and Shelters. And we're just discussing his latest novel, his first foray into the world of fiction. And it's called The Pulse, a novel of surviving the collapse of the grid. And Scott, you're a pretty prolific guy, and you've got a couple other projects in the work. Why don't you tell us a little bit about The next book you have coming out, your next nonfiction book.
Well, one of them is, the next one that's going to be coming out is actually a, it's more of a book of lists. It's a checklist, it's sort of a checklist book for preppers, but it's going to have checklists for all sorts of things and kind of a workbook type of deal, you know, more than an instructional or how-to book. I thought it would be handy to have all this, you know, in one place, you know, like a quick reference, you know, a checklist, because that's something that I've always been a real fanatic about checklists with my own, you know, in my travels, kayaking and sailing and backpacking, you know, anytime I go anywhere or do anything, you know, I've got these checklists, and I think that's something that people, you know, need to be aware of. You know, a lot of my other books all have checklists in them as well, but this will be a little different, you know, so that's the next project.
Oh yeah, checklists are, I can't stress the importance of that enough, because I know from personal experience, you know, years ago, just on camping trips, you know, it's like you think that you've thought of everything, you think you've taken everything you need with you, and invariably, you will always find that you just spaced it on one particular item that may or may not be essential. At the time, sometimes they're just items that are just good to have, but they're not, you know, something that you absolutely need. Other times, you know, like I was on a trip once when the person I was camping with brought the wrong sleeping bag. You know, he brought his summer bag instead of his winter bag, and and hypothermia. It was cold, man, and if I didn't happen to bring along extra blankets and gear and stuff like that, it would have been very he could have got hypothermia. But it, you know, there are other instances, and that's when I learned that, you know, you just can't count on your own memory or your own reckoning of like, yeah, I think I got all I need. You really need to have a plan. You need to have everything checked off. And we're just talking about camping here, folks. We're not talking about a Teotihuacan event or, you know, end of the world as we know it kind of scenario. So, yeah, I'm the kind of person, like, by nature, I really like to get up and go, and I'm, like, you know, action-oriented. I just, like, you know, I want to get it done. I want to get up and go and do it. But it's really imperative to do it when you're talking about your, you know, a life-or-death situation or a survival situation. So that's great to hear. What else you got in the works?
Well, the other one is still a little bit, you know, we're flexible on the other one. I've been talking to my editor about it. I mean, it's a possible, you know, third bug-out book, you know, but I actually may do the sequel to The Pulse before that, so we're... You know, that's not nailed down yet. I mean, all this is going to be stuff that's going to be coming out in 2013 anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm working on, you know, I'm writing, you know, but I don't know which order they're going to actually come out in yet. You know, it just depends.
Right.
I mean, I have lots of other ideas, and, you know, especially for fiction, you know, I want to do more of the fiction in the future. So I'm going to stay busy, you know, writing one way or the other. So.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great idea to continue with the fiction. I mean, the nonfiction is great and everything, and it's vital information that people need to know. But you know, like I said before, you have the ability, you have a vehicle to reach more people and to wake more people up with the fiction than you do the nonfiction, because a non-prepper or non-survivalist is never going to pick up bug out vehicles. You know, or, you know, your other survival books, whereas this is a compelling enough story that, you know, I'm all about reaching as many people as possible and broadcasting the message of survival and preparedness, and also broadcasting to people the reasons, you know, that we need to be prepared. And there's an awful lot of people who may not agree with me on that. I mean, I've had people with my show or some of my writing where they say, well, you know, why are you wasting your time talking about the reasons to prepare? It's like, because not everybody knows this. Not everybody is aware of these, are aware of these things. You and I, you know, sure, we're well-versed in all of the dangers, and there's many of them. And you know, solar flare EMP is not to be discounted. But you really need to reach the people, reach the unconverted, as it were.
Right. And, you know, I chose the EMP as just a device to put the characters in that situation. I just wanted to show how people, you know, could leave a city and how they might survive when they get to the woods that they're going to be in, and how somebody might get back to the mainland on a sailboat if they didn't have any other way to get back, if all the airplanes were down and they couldn't fly. You know, so it's all those kind of things, you know, those what else, you know, that I wanted to portray. So it could have been a different disaster altogether. It could have been something else, but I chose the, you know, the solar flare for that reason. But, you know, any number of scenarios could be incorporated. I mean, there are so many. I don't know if you've looked at all the books that are coming out all the time on Amazon now. You can see all these, you know, there's all sorts of apocalyptic novels, you know, both published and self-published, you know, and from many, many different authors. About a lot of them have the solar flare premise, or the, you know, the man-made EMP, or, you know, some other disaster, economic collapse on the edge. And there's just a lot of them out there. So that's a popular genre right now.
Oh, sure. And that's in no small part to the whole, you know, 2012 doomsday.
Right.
You know, when you said anytime I hear anybody in the survival community, you know, you say, well, you know, those books will be coming out in 2013. And it's a joke, folks. It's a joke. But
yeah.
I usually say, don't bother. The world's going to end this
right.
year. Don't you know that?
Don't bother. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got the advances for those books already, so if it happens, then we'll
Yeah, you ought to get paid. Don't make any plans for January 2nd or December 22nd, folks. You know,
right.
Now, obviously, you know, we're all level-headed people, and for people on the outside, and that's another good service that this book is doing, is for people who are outside of the survivalist and preparedness community, you know, it really goes a long way in showing that, you know, we're not all nut jobs, we're not all kooks out here, we're not all praying for the end of the world or, you know, anticipating, you know, I would say there's probably a small segment of the survivalist and prepper population who's actually looking forward to a reset of society. I have my feelings about that subject as well. I don't think we need a reset. I don't think that the human race is as vile and despicable as, you know, the media would have you believe. But this, you know, this book is really, you know, a common sense thing. It's not a zombie apocalypse. It's not, you know, anything that's really far out there. And, you know, and it really kind of casts the survivalist mindset, or the survivalist, you know, persona, or whatever you want to call it, in a very positive light, where it's like, yeah, this is something that you don't have to be embarrassed about if you're, like, you know, one of the newbies, if you're just waking up or you just figuring this stuff out. You know, it's very accessible, I guess, is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah. And not to give away too much, but, you know, there's a character sort of like that, what you're talking about, coming up. I just won't tell you where, but you will meet one. I think you'd read.
Oh, good. I can't wait. And we can come back and revise my my opinion of what I just said. But yeah, it's a great read. It's an entertaining read, and that's the most important. You know, like we said earlier at the opening of the interview, it's like, you know, it definitely keeps you turning the pages, and that's really what you want to do. You know, because I have to, throughout the course of my work, I mean, I largely speak to people who are already on board, or are, as Adam Francis from Equipped to Endure likes to call us. You know, I talk mainly to the true believers, but when I do, I also have a lot of encounters with people who, yeah, they may need a little convincing, you know. And I think this book would go a long way in doing that, and letting people in on the fact that, yeah, it doesn't have to be a nuclear war or a zombie apocalypse. It could be just something as simple as losing our electrical. We don't live in a society that has an infrastructure for, you know, to live in a non-electrified world, or a non-petroleum world for that matter. And with a grid crash, you know, you get in two disasters in one. And not only is the electricity going to be gone, but we're not going to have any more petroleum, no more gasoline flowing either. And, you know, you really covered a lot of that in the book with in regards to all of the side effects and all of the unanticipated things that come about with the loss of our power grid.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing is, I mean, you can imagine in a city like New Orleans with the loss of the power grid, how quickly, you know, the grocery stores would be cleaned out. I mean, it would happen so fast. I mean, all they have to do is put out a hurricane evacuation warning down on, you know, any of the coastal cities on the Gulf Coast, and people, even if it's not even, you know, they can put out a warning that the storm can still be way out in the Caribbean somewhere, and they put out a warning and people just flock to the supermarkets and clean them out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They do that here in, you know, here in South Mississippi, in the very rare winter storm that comes through, if we're going to have like 3 or 4 inches of snow, you know, people just panic and freak out and go to the grocery stores and clean out the shelves, you know, thinking they're going to be snowed in. We get snow here that lasts, you know, it might last overnight and then it melts the next morning, and that might happen once every 5 years.
Well, you know, the same thing happens here in New England. And I mean, well, of course, we do have you know, the nor'easters, as they're called, and the blizzards and whatnot, where people do get snowed in for days or a week or two at a time. But I see it too. And I always find it, I don't want to say it's amusing, because, you know, well, to see the unprepared and, you know, there's a storm coming or whatnot, and, you know, seeing the grocery stores where the parking lot is just jam-packed and the people are lining up, you know, the registers are lined up for, you know, there's all, you know, completely packed, and all the staples are gone, the bread's gone, the water, the bottled water is all gone, and everything like that. And it's amusing to me, or at least when you're prepared, you know, you don't have to worry about that stuff. And it's just funny watching the mad rush, you know. It's like, oh, at the 11th hour, we're going to run out, we got to go and get, you know, get all of our staples and everything like that, and you know, waiting in these long lines and everything. And I haven't had to do that for years. You know, I could just drive on by. It's like, ah, see you suckers, I'm already prepared for this, you know. And
well, yeah, that's like me. Even before all the interest in prepping and survivalism came along, I've been living this lifestyle so long, not survivalist thinking, but just the fact that I've been traveling, you know, kayaking and, you know, camping and sailing, and, you know, I've just always had my gear pretty much packed for the next trip. You know, I'll come back from a trip and the stuff is all still there, and whatever food's left over stays either on the boat or in the backpack or whatever, and I've got, you know, extra stuff, you know, wherever I'm living at the time, and it's just, you know, it's just always there and kind of ready to go. So I was doing that before, you know, the term bug out bag was even in use, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of ready to go anyway, just because I was always anticipating the next trip. And people that have, you know, the larger sailboats especially are that way, because, you know, a cruising type boat can carry a month or several months supplies of food at any time anyway. So most people that actually use their boats to go places have them pretty well stocked up.
Mm-hmm. You know, another interesting thing that you had in the book that was kind of, again, kind of amusing is that you have Casey's roommate, Jessica, the vegetarian.
Yeah.
There's that line when they were when Grant was describing the natives in the Amazon and told her that they were hunter gatherers, and she's like, "Oh, hunters! Well, that's just wrong."
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, this is a very, very common thing, you know, with teenage girls, particularly, you know, in America now. I mean, it's just, you know, vegetarian, I mean, it's just kind of swept the nation, I think. And the reason I know about this is because my own stepdaughter, you know, at that age, she's the same age as the characters in the book, and watching her grow up and, you know, talking to her and her friends and, you know, just hearing the things that they think and see and do and all that. I mean, it inspired both of those characters, you know. There's, you know, one's a vegetarian, one's not, but I kind of had some insight into that thinking, you know, because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting.
It was funny. We said, well, don't they know that they don't have to do that, you know? And you're talking about native peoples who have been living this way for thousands and thousands of years, if not millions of years.
Yeah.
You know, like, don't they know that that's wrong, that they don't have to do that?
Yeah. But you know, there are a lot of people who think that way, you know. I mean, it's just because, and it's more people that are, you know, especially more urban people that are cut off from where the food comes from, and, they just don't really connect it all together, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a sister-in-law who, and not the brightest bulb on the Christmas tree, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, and she doesn't listen to my show. So besides, yeah. I think she knows this already. But, yeah, it's amazing that she literally, she freely admits this, that at one time she had no idea where meat, you know, she was like the typical American. Meat comes on styrofoam trays wrapped in plastic, you know,
yeah.
Never gave a second thought to actually, you know, meat production or what goes into it, what's involved in it, how the animals are treated and everything like that. And so, yeah, there is a, you know, we live in a society of people who think that our food just comes from nature in cellophane packages and we just throw it in the microwave, and that's the way it's always been.
Yeah, well, you know, in the case of my own stepdaughter, there's the turning point. You know, what happened is they, one of the teachers in school, you know, when they were maybe, the junior high or something at the school she went to, they showed a film on factory farming, you know, portraying, you know, like the worst practices, you know, and just making the whole meat industry out to be so inhumane and barbaric and cruel, you know, and I mean, it was just kind of targeted toward kids that age, you know, that are very impressionable.
Right. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, yeah, there are, I mean, there are some things, you know, some bad things going on in the industry, of course, in some cases, but I mean, you know, like I said, that, I think that's where a lot of that thinking comes from, just things that they see, you know, and hear other people talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm not a fan of factory farming, and I'm a big,
right.
I'm a big opponent of, you know, with all the hormones and the antibiotics
sure.
and everything, and, you know, our whole food industry is insane, you know, and I don't even get me started on Monsanto and, you know, the GMOs
yeah.
and all that crap. But
right.
I'm not a big fan of that, but, you know, I'm also not a big fan of the fact that our school system has an agenda of teaching our children this radical, you know, radical environmentalism and radical animal rights mindset. Where
right.
Whereas, like, yeah, the factory farms are awful. They're despicable. I would love to see them wiped off the face of the planet. But on the other hand, you know, I have no problems with the consumption of meat. I mean, we humans are omnivores. We are hunter-gatherers. We're predators. We have eyes in the front of our heads. We have the incisors and the teeth that are designed for, you know, and also the digestive system for processing meat. I believe in it in moderation. I think it's in... you know, should be in balance with, you know, vegetables and other food sources. But, yeah, that's where we're going is, like, all of our kids are, the school system is brainwashing and turning on their parents and, you know, making them believe that, you know, if you toss a soda can in the trash and you don't recycle it, then you deserve to be taken out and shot, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, another reason I had to, and it's just, you know, something that interested the book. But I mean, the other reason I even had a character that was a vegetarian, you know, but, you know, on purpose in my writing there was just to show that in this sort of situation where they actually, you know, later on in the book where they're out, you know, in the woods and swamps, you know, South Mississippi on the rivers, that, you know, a vegetarian diet is really not sustainable, you know, when you're on the move and you're trying to live off the land. It would be, you know, very few people could do that anyway very well for a long period of time, but trying to live off the land without, you know, eating some kind of animal, you know, fish or, you know, reptiles, amphibians or whatever you could catch would be really difficult for anybody, even the most expert hunter-gatherer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are people who can do it. You know, I had to rescind, you know, one of my, I guess, my typical responses, you know, when for years when people ask me, you know, like, well, I'm a vegetarian and, you know, what do I, you know, how can a, what advice do you have for a vegetarian if they have to survive out in the wilderness? I said, the only advice I can give you is learn how to hunt, you know, because
yeah.
you're going to be hard pressed to survive just on foraging alone, you know, and based on caloric intake and, you know, the fatty acids and the proteins and everything that are required. But however, the reason why I say I've had to take that back is because I do know people. I personally, Sergey Botenko, he's a wild edibles expert, and he survived, he hiked the Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada, and they were sending food to various post office stops along their route, and they miscalculated how much food they were going to consume. And so for a great part of that that trip, that hike, they had to survive on you know, whatever wild edibles. And of course, he's a vegetarian as well, but he was already accustomed to that. He was already accustomed to, you're not going to go from being a meat and potatoes guy one day and then all of a sudden disaster strikes and you're out there and you're just going to go and start eating weeds, which is very doable. It's very, you know, it can be done, but it's not going to be something that most people not going to be able to make that transition of just like, oh, well, I'm just going to eat wild edibles and that's it. That's going to be, you know, my entire diet. So yeah, that's a good thing that you put that in there.
If you knew, yeah, if you're an expert at wild animals and you know enough about them to know all the varieties that are available in a region, yeah, I could see where, you know, someone could do well doing that. You know, it's just that very few people even know, you know, what they can or cannot eat. You know, that's the thing, and it takes time, you know, to learn those skills and then how to prepare the different things that you could find. But here, especially in the south, along the rivers, there are, you know, lots of variety of wild edibles, you know, plants, you know, available year-round, too. You know, there's plenty you could find if you knew enough about it, mm-hmm. No doubt about that. But there's also, you know, lots of good hunting, too, and, you know, all kinds of fish and everything, you know, all sorts of creatures, especially in the swamps. So living off the land would be easier here than in many places.
Yeah, there's all kinds of you know, wild edibles wherever you are. I mean, you know, I mean, unless you're deep in the heart of the inner city or something like that.
Right.
But you know, and that's something that took me a while to learn, because, like I said, I was, you know, like I always knew. I think I learned enough about wild edibles to where I was satisfied, and I figured, okay, I know enough about this, but I never really, you know, went any deeper than that. And then when I started learning more about, you know, I mean, basically it's easier to tell people what plants you can't eat than go through the numerous plants that you can eat. And
yeah,
you basically, you know, like if you're anywhere near, you know, somewhat semi, even in a suburban area, you can find plenty of food to eat. There's food all around. I don't think that starvation in a survival situation, it'll be rough. You know, it's like you're not going to dig it, and your energy level might be down. And if you don't know, like, what kind of plants to combine for, you know, to form a complete protein or things like that, then you'll be in trouble. But yeah, it's definitely doable, but it's not something you can go like, yeah, just cold turkey. You know, it's like all of a sudden, right, oh, I'm just going to eat weeds now. But it's a lot less severe. I guess what I'm trying to say is, the possibility of doing it, it's a lot greater than what I had originally thought, and it's a lot greater than what a lot of other people think in terms of you know, foraging for your survival. It can be done.
Yeah, it can be done. I think too many people dismiss it and think that you can't do it. You know,
exactly. That.
Yeah,
thank you.
Because they can't do it, they just say everything. You know, I know no one can do it. But that's, mm-hmm. You know, I've had a lot of that. You know, regarding my bug out books, I've had other people in the survival and prepping community, you know, criticize that because they say, you know, you can't do this. You know, but I know for a fact I can do it. I've done it, and I know other people that can do it, and I know people that are not even. They would never consider themselves survivalists. They're just some of these good old boy hunters, you know, from around here that I grew up with. And you could drop those guys off, you know, in the woods with a .22 rifle or a shotgun, and, you know, they could stay out there for months if they had enough ammo, you know, live off the land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I have a neighbor, and he is a vegetarian. Even he was skeptical about that. You know, up here in I live in a rural part of northern New Hampshire. And, you know, we were out one time. I had to do a video for this TV show that I've been working with over the last couple of months. And I was doing a segment on wild edibles, and he volunteered to do the camera work and everything. And even he was surprised. I mean, you know, you look around here and you don't really, to the untrained eye, I guess, you don't see food, you know. And he was a vegetarian, and we're going, you know, just walking through this field, and I picked out like 8 plants, like one after the other. You know, it's like this, you can eat this, you can eat this, you can eat that. And he's like, really? I see this every day, and I had no idea that it was food, that you could actually eat it. It's like every single weed you see here, you could eat it. In fact, I was like trying to find something that you couldn't eat. You know, well, let's see, the pine needles. No, I won't eat the pine needles off the trees. You can make a tea out of it, though. But I couldn't find anything growing around us that was not edible.
I've eaten the inner bark of pine trees. One winter camping trip that I did here, where I was out doing an experiment for like 3 weeks on living off the land, and there's not as much around in the wintertime. Not many green herbs and things like that available. So I did strip some inner bark from pine trees and roasted that, and that's edible.
Oh, the inner bark. And actually, I should take that back too, because this doesn't help you in the wintertime, but the young new tender pine needles, you can eat those.
Right.
But what I was talking about is the mature, the ponderosa or that kind of stuff. I don't want to be gnawing on that. That's
no.
But the tender, the fresh, new, young, you can eat those as well. And he was just amazed that there was just so much around that we had clover, we had plantain, we had mustard, we had just dandelions, of course, all kinds of stuff that was growing around, and he was very, very surprised that it was like a supermarket. We were in the middle of a natural supermarket.
Right.
Well, Scott, I was glad to have you on the show. I'm glad you could be here to share with us your book. And I want to mention to our listeners that if you can get Scott's book, it's called The Pulse, and that'll be available on survivalandbeyond.net. You can get it there, or you can go to, why don't you tell our listeners where else they can get your book, Scott?
Oh, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, all the online retailers that sell books, and then, they should be in the stores as well, and Barnes & Noble and Books A Million chains, I know they have them in the stores, so, lots of places to get it, and you can always go to my main website, to find links to my Amazon page and all that at scottdwilliams.com. I don't sell books directly off the site, but there'll be updates and information about the current books and anything I've got coming out in the future.
Awesome. All right, Scott. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and really, I'm not giving you lip service here because you're my guest. I mean, I'm really digging the book, and to all my listeners, I really recommend that you pick this book up. I think it's enlightening, it's entertaining, and it's educational all in one. And it's not an onerous read. You're not going to be belabored with all kinds of technical information that bogs the story down. And but there's definitely some stuff you can learn, and give it to your friends if you have anybody who's on the fence, or they're in denial, or they're still asleep and they don't think that this is anything to worry about, makes a great gift, and you'll be waking people up at the same time. So, Scott, once again, thanks for being on the show, and hope to have you back on real soon.
Thank you, Ed. Enjoyed it.
And that about does it for this installment of Survival and Beyond. I want to thank you all for listening. And don't forget to check out the website at survivalandbeyond.net, where you'll get all your news and information, as well as survival guides, free for downloading, videos, all kinds of great stuff. That's survivalandbeyond.net. And until next week, folks, as usual, just keep your head up and keep on living free. And don't take any crap from anybody.